If you're going to make $2 million and you believe you'll make $2 million, everyone can find $300,000. To make $2 million, you will absolutely freaking do that. And that's what we did, and it wasn't hard. It took 4 phone calls. I'd never raised money before. Everyone I raised from, I'd never met before. It took 4 phone calls, 3 people came together, funded the deal. Bought them out in 11 months. That is how the game's played. Don't have steps.
Welcome to Investing in the US, a podcast for real estate investors, business owners, and aspiring entrepreneurs looking to grow their wealth by investing in US real estate. I'm your host, Reid Goossens, and so far, I've acquired over $800 million worth of investments on various properties across the United States. On this podcast, I interview go-getters, risk takers, and the best in the business to learn more about their investment journey and the cutting-edge strategies they are applying towards building a legacy. For more on growing your own wealth and by investing in the US, visit www.reidgoossens.com. Today on the show, the pleasure of speaking with Christian Osgood. Christian is a real estate investor and the host of the Multifamily Strategy podcast, and he specializes in helping others achieve financial independence through multifamily investing. Starting with hard work and saving, Christian acquired his first properties, and after a life-changing event in 2020, he set a goal to retire him and his wife and relocate to the state of Texas. In just 3 years, he has grown his portfolio to over 200 rental properties, and today, Christian and his wife, Danny, run the Multifamily Strategy podcast and multiple property management companies whilst mentoring others to achieve financial freedom through creative financing and multifamily investing. I'm really pumped and excited to have him on the show today to share his incredible knowledge and insight. But enough out of me, let's get him out here. G'day, Christian. Welcome to the show. How are you doing today, mate?
Dude, I am doing absolutely fantastic because we're taking this call from Texas, where we finally made it. Moved just about 90 days ago and had our first kid about 60 days ago. So we hit that deadline just about the last day that you're allowed to fly pregnant. My wife made it down. So our kid is a native born Texan. We were able to do the thing. And that was the final goal on the checklist. Retire wife, build the house, start a family. So
that's awesome. One
of the first podcasts I've got to share the full story on. We actually hit every single goal just a few months ago.
Did you have the hospital lined up knowing, giving you that close to the due date?
You know, it was funny is that they wouldn't accept us until we made the move. And so we had an idea of what hospital we wanted to do, but we weren't able to confirm it until after we moved down. And of course, as soon as we moved, the hospital we wanted to go to said, oh, you know what? Actually, we're completely full. We're booked out. So had to find a hospital about an hour away, but we got it done. We did the main thing. I have a healthy baby boy named Xander, which is an awesome, awesome start. So hopefully many more kids to come, but we did the thing.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Let's rewind the clock and I ask all the people who come on my podcast, can you rewind the clock and tell me how you made your first ever dollar as a kid?
First ever dollar as a kid. I made the first ever dollar that I made teaching guitar lessons from my family living room. My mother actually used to, or she still is. My mother's a Braillist, so she's assigned to individual blind children, and she'll usually roll with them all the way from kindergarten all the way through 12. So she'll do a full cycle where she's assigned a kid all the way through their career. So I actually had some students who were blind, and you teach them music, which is a really cool thing to get to do. So that was like a few guitar lessons. Later graduated to swimming lessons, but I did everything like the traditional way. Like I got like, that was a little bit entrepreneurial, but it was more just, you know, someone asked if I could do that. And I was like, sure, let's make it happen.
Awesome.
From there, I did it so traditional. For the rest of my money for the next like 12 years, I went through and I did the whole Dave Ramsey thing, like work, save, try to invest, super slow way to go about it. But I did not know there was another way to play the game for a long, long time. So most of the beginning of my stories, like super boring, like first grade to second grade, middle to high school to college to first, second, third job. Pretty vanilla backstory if you really dig into it.
But what was the impetus to get into multifamily investing? You mentioned Dave Ramsey. Clearly you wanted something more. You know, you already mentioned you've had some goals to move to Texas, start a family, all that sort of stuff. So like clearly there was something there that inspired you to do more with your life.
Yeah, with the finance side, I've always given a lot of thought to finances. I grew up in a lower middle class house, but a single family or single parent income. So mom stayed at home. So my dad was able to provide for me and my two sisters, which is awesome. The cost of that was I didn't see a whole heck of a lot of them. I saw them on weekends usually during the weekdays. He had like a 2-hour commute to work. So 4 hours round trip commute, often a 9-hour workday. He did an awesome job providing for us, but I didn't get enough time with him until he, you know, later in life, he retired after I graduated college. I've got a lot closer with him. I wanted to, from a very young age, I was like, that is not what I want to do. I want to figure out a way to provide like my dad provides, but spend time with my kids like I didn't get to have with him until he was a little bit older. So how can you do both at the same time? I was immediately interested in real estate, like as far back as I can remember. I was like, this makes sense. People need housing. There's houses everywhere. Drive literally anywhere. Look around. There's, you know, multifamily buildings. Buildings everywhere. Someone owns every single one. So that concept was never lost on me. Where I got stuck is I thought, hey, you have to save up for each and every one of these and diligently make sure you have the money, buy a first property. A few years later, buy another duplex. I ended up in a place where I had two duplexes and my single family house that I lived in. The cash flow from those two duplexes was just enough to cover the mortgage on the house. So I got to a place after 8 years of working, after 4 years of college, where my real estate was paying for my real estate, which felt really good. But to answer your question directly, the impetus, the moment where I was like, I need to do something else, my wife got injured right after we came back from COVID. So we come back, the whole planet's been shut down. She's been teaching kindergartners over Zoom. Like within the first few months, she gets injured on the playground. The school tries to cover it up, and we just had enough of having enough. I was like, there needs to be another way to do this. I need to figure out in the next couple of years how I can retire my wife. And of course, I had just left my relatively high-paying job I'd worked forever to achieve so that I can go out and be an investor. So I'm like, I have to figure out how to go from $2,000 a month in passive investments to $15,000 to retire my wife, to go full-time into real estate, to move to Texas, to hit all the goals. I'm like, I need to get to $15,000. How do we do this? And so that's really where the adventure began, is I had a major life change where it wasn't just, I want more money. It became, hey, I urgently have a very specific goal with a very specific cost that I want to hit as soon as humanly possible. And that changed everything for me.
Yeah, no, laser focused on that specificity. What job did you leave, by the way?
I was working for the CoStar Group. So they own basically all the commercial real estate data.
Yep.
So they own LoopNet, Homes.com, Apartments.com. They are the largest research organization in the U.S. outside of the U.S. Census Bureau. They are titanically huge. I sold for them for a long time. I actually did very, very, very well there, but was making about $250,000 a year earned income. By the way, I started my first ever job out of college was printing T-shirts for $11.50 an hour. So I scaled from $11.50 an hour to working for the supplier to working for Lands.com, which CoStar bought, and I worked my way up that company. I did the traditional thing that one would do to earn more money, and where that got me was a tiny 1955 super cute house in Renton, Washington, but it was a 1,200 square foot old house and a couple of old rental properties that both cash flowed about $1,000 a month. It's not a bad financial place to be. Home ownership, couple of rentals, but it certainly wasn't financial freedom. And by most traditional standards, $250,000 earned income is pretty good. There's certainly people who make a lot more, but there's a lot of people who make a lot less. That was considered, I mean, if you go through like what is the standard path to become wealthy, I think that's what's preached to most people. And so what I found after 4 years of school and 8 years of working really hard, that was nowhere close to financial freedom. That was just, I'm a little bit farther ahead than people, you know, than other people my age. It wasn't anything special. After that point, it started getting a lot more special once we kind of figured out, okay, well, we got to that 15,000 and we did it in a few transactions and we did it. It took me 11 months to pick up the next $13,000 a month of cash flow, which is crazy.
Which is nuts. Well, let's talk about it. So look, how did you go about doing the next 15 or $13,000?
So I left CoStar Group. I went to a small little brokerage that specialized in small multifamily because that's where I was still mentally stuck. I was like, I'm buying duplexes. I need to buy the duplexes and fourplexes, and that's what I knew to do. So I was like, let's get around the people who are doing the thing that I want to do. If I want to be an investor, let's get around the people who are investing. That was the logic. The way I went about it was stupid. I was like, I'm going to get my broker's license like a lot of people do. Side note, if you're thinking about getting your real estate license to be a better investor, that is, you want to be a real estate agent, get your license. If you want to be a real estate investor, buy real estate. They're not the same thing. But that was the logic. So I had left to this firm. And there was a 19-year-old. He turned 20 right as I moved into the office. He worked at a building, same company, but worked at the building a couple blocks down. He had 24 rentals. He'd never had a W-2. Oh, that's not true. He worked at Safeway, the grocery store, for 36 minutes before he's like, I don't like this. And he left. So he virtually never had a W-2. He had sold one deal for like a $5,000 commission. And in high school, I think he coached gymnastics part-time. Like, he's never actually earned any money. He has 24 rental properties. They're paying him thousands of dollars a month. I bought my second duplex, and right across the street from that duplex, he buys a sixplex. So he's 20 years old. He has 30 rental units. His cash flow at the time was about $6,000-$7,000 a month. I'm like, that's more than you've ever earned in all of your jobs combined. And you make that every month. How are you doing this? He's like, well, there's this deal and someone's client filled out a contract and I called them and they said they would actually hold the contract for me and they only need 10% down. I'm like, okay, so how did that come about? He's like, well, instead of asking them to sell the property, I just met with them and told them what I'm trying to do. And I told them, hey, I have I want to get into rentals like this one day. Do you mind? He actually asked him if he could broker the deal. He was calling just seeing if he can pick up business. They're like, well, if you want to own rentals like this one day, why don't you buy it? He's like, well, because I don't have any money. So the actual seller of that building introduced him to the concept of seller financing. And he's like, here's what you need to do. I know you don't have the money. I'll finance 90% of it. If you can show me that you can come out and find the other 10, we have a deal. He did go out and find that other 10. He actually raised it as debt. He got a second against the building. 100% finance with a first and second position, bought the building. Paid out the investor 2 years later out of the appreciation of the property and the cash flow of the property. Did the same thing with another owner. Goes to another 12-plex. The guy goes out and meets him. He takes out a paper plate, writes some numbers on the back. And he's like, here's how the property's doing. And then he took a picture of the plate and sent him a picture of the plate. So my buddy Cody comes in and underwrites the entire deal off not even the paper plate with the numbers, but the picture of the paper plate with the numbers. heavy value add, a lot of management to do there because that was the books. The books was the back of the paper plate. A bank would never have financed that in a million years. He came in, he bought the property, excellent price, needed a lot of work. He put in the sweat equity. Same thing with the sixplex. When I met him, I asked him, hey, I was just about to turn 29. I'm just about 29. You're at 30 units. Would it be feasible for someone like me to get to 30 units by the age of 30? That just seemed like a good first step. It's arbitrary. Unit count doesn't matter, but that felt good. That felt attainable. Like, you're 20 years old with 30 units. Could I do this in 1 year? You did it in 2.5. He's like, no, I can't help you because I need a partner to help me take out a 38 unit, seller financed. It's on market right now, and that'll put you at 42, not 30. And my decision to say yes to that started a cascade of deals that came out just about the same way. We bought that thing 85% seller financed. I had never raised capital before in my life, no friends or family with money. What I learned from this, and this is the biggest lesson of my life, this is the thing that changed. It's not, do I have the money? Like the Dave Ramsey model showed, it's like, go earn the money. Do you have an opportunity? It is so easy to tailor money to a deal. It's really hard to tailor a deal to specific money. If you try to raise capital beforehand, so say someone comes in and says, hey, I'll lend you money at 12%. I can only do deals that cash flow significantly over 12% day one. Like I would need to have an 18% cash on cash return to take their money for me to make 6% and for them to make 12. But I found a deal with Cody where it barely cash flowed at all day one, but it had $2 million of upside. We factored for $1 million. We bought it for two. We were like, we can definitely get this worth three. When appraisal came in, it appraised for $4.1 million 11 months later, which is crazy. But on that deal, it didn't have the cash flow. That's why everyone else passed on it. It was on market for 13 years. We met with the seller, figured out what they needed, wrote terms that worked for us. We actually had lower payments for the first 6 months, so that we can cash flow while we started fixing collections and leasing up the units. We got the income from $5,000 a month to, in the first 6 months, it was bringing in over $23,000 a month. Our mortgage went from a couple thousand dollars to $10,000 a month, but it was only 4% interest. We were massively paying down principal, and the property was able to cash flow really strongly month after month after month. We were able to pay ourselves, and eventually, when we refinanced, we took out some money from the property. We paid out the investors. We got the real estate to buy the real estate. And we've done that on tons of deals.
Where are all these properties?
I started in Moses Lake, Washington, Central Washington, right off I-90. I bought a deal out in Bremerton, and later on we went through Mason County, bought a RV park out there, bought a resort out there, which I deeply regret. Don't buy resorts. Hospitality is not multifamily. That's a totally different business. Then I, when I knew I was going to move to Texas, I started buying in Texas. So I own McAllen, Laredo, Houston, Stephenville, Fort Worth. Just passed on a deal in Waco that we were under contract for. I almost had a ton of units in Waco, but changed my mind at the last minute.
What's the who's managing all these, particularly on the small side? Like, because we own at RSM Property Group, 4,500 units. We've got all professional property management. How do you nail that sub 50 unit property management space?
I'm glad you asked that. No one ever asked me that, by the way. Started my own property management companies. What I found, because I love secondary and tertiary markets. I've bought in Seattle. Like we did a deal where we made a ton of money in like Seattle downtown. Mm-hmm. But I found that your odds of finding people who are in a position to sell or finance and to build meaningful relationships are easier when you're a little bit outside of the major metros. Yep. And so for mid-sized multifamily, to find someone who is good at managing it, there's two things that I think you need. One, you need a decentralized management model where it's not all on-site. It gets a little bit cost ineffective to plant a bunch of on-site people on a bunch of mid-sized properties. You need to have a team that can service multiple properties. So same team, centralized, but they can regularly visit the property. It's like having them on-site, but they service a zone. If you think of it in football terms, for us Americans, it's like playing zone versus man-to-man. On larger buildings, you put man on each building. The management style for this is done better in zones where you have your contractors, your team, your managers running a zone and you plan it out through their day. I have found that in the smaller markets, I've yet to find someone who can outcompete me and my team. So even though property management is a low margin, hard business, I have chosen to hire my own teams and do my own model for every market that I've been in. So gotcha. Moses Lake owned a PM company, Texas owned a PM company. Actually, just sold my Washington PM company. Now that it's stabilized and actually had the systems, mm-hmm. I sold that seller financed to a fantastic operator. And I would argue the company's got even better under their leadership, which has been awesome.
That's the number one thing that it comes to mind is like, you pitch and sell the dream to our listeners. But at the end of the day, it's all about property management. Like it's who can put the heads in the beds. If you can't, that deal you spoke about, that 32 unit, if you couldn't turn it around, if you couldn't get the delinquency out, like who's doing that work day in, day out?
There was no PM in that market that would have done that work.
Right.
The biggest property manager in town, they weren't actually managing it, but one of the people in their company, their family owned the building. So it's like their family... The building was owned by a family that runs the largest PM company in town, and they were absolutely failing. So the only option was, if we're going to take this out, we have to be the ones to do it. And getting through that heart of a project, a 38-unit building that only has 5,000 in collections, that had a lot of problems. Homeless camp on the back.
So what did you do? Walk us through what you did there. Because that it's not about the success stories. It's about those little, like, I'm an operator, been an operator for a decade. Like, that's stuff like that. I still use third-party property management because it's, go above 150 units, get the scale, and it works, right? Yeah. But, in the smaller stuff where that opportunity is to get seller carrying finance, because I tell you what, no one's seller carrying financing on 150 units, I can tell you that, or more. Like these are institutional owners and these are bigger owners that at least in the markets I play in, you're going to go through a property management.
It doesn't happen often. I've seen on occasion on like I was looking at a 200 something unit deal in Houston, actually. Mm-hmm. Actually pretty decent building. I would call it solid class B. It's the type of neighborhood, it would never be an A, but it was in just excellent condition, three-story walk-up. They were seller financing because they're like, the building's big enough for like, we don't have anything to 1031 into. We also want out. We don't want the tax hit. We've paid this thing down astronomically. They're like, if you guys can swing 25% down, that's about the debt we have. They're less common though. On that size, it's rare. I've seen it. You can buy multi-hundred unit seller financed.
And just not as prevalent. But
I would call that more of a unicorn deal, whereas you have, I don't want to say it's impossible. I know it's out there, but it's much, much, much more common for people to roll down the debt to where they're in a position on a 25 unit, on a 55 100%. Unit. I would say, but then, 75 units and below, it's much more common.
But then you've got the opposite where it's on that 200 units, it's easier to get a property management company. It's easier to go and,
oh my gosh, yeah.
You know but it's pros and cons. So let's go back to the cons of doing smaller, the 32 unit. Like, what did you do to roll up the sleeve and say, you know what, I'm gonna kick these people out. I'm gonna create a decentralized property management company, because not everyone will just go out and do that day one, right? So it's like, walk us through those steps and how that build out, because it's not just a click of the fingers or a turning on of the light that all of a sudden everything starts to work.
So remember, I left a high income job. I used all the money that I made from that to buy the duplexes in the house. So I had no cash. So the easy thing to do is you go buy an existing company and you tailor it to your needs. That is that statistically, your odds of success there are unbelievably higher. If you have no money and no resources, you have to build it yourself from scratch. That is the hard part of being a solopreneur in the beginning is, or I guess I had one partner, but you know what I mean. If you're a small group, you have no money, you roll up your sleeves and you get to work. We went out there, problems that we had to address. Of the four roofs, one was bad. Don't have the qualifications for it, needs to be a contractor. So, okay, can't manually do that. Homeless camp on the back. They were stealing power from us. They were living in cars in the back, and it was a disaster. Conveniently, a developer had bought the property next door. We were able to, while we're under due diligence, get together with that developer. The problem that we kept having is the homeless would be on our property. And then when the police came, they would walk onto the vacant lot next door, and they said, oh, we're not on this property. And then the police would leave. Welcome to Washington State. That's all the police can do. Were you on that property? No. that's how that conversation went between them and the homeless. I talked to the next door neighbor, and in due diligence, we figured out that they're actually building a brick wall all the way around our property line. We coordinated with them to have the police come and say, hey, either side of this lot line, you guys need to clear out. So we got the homeless camp resolved in like 2 days. Which was the scariest part of the whole project, is there's a ton of homeless everywhere. We got it resolved in 2 days. 2 months later, there's a actually really pretty, like it's a very aesthetic brick wall all the way around our campus. So I'm like, this is perfect. That solved itself. The collections were bad because none of the maintenance was done. You had a bunch of the old owners had a bunch of their old family members in there. They had a bunch of just like, it was super messy. The first thing that we did, and this is a great piece of, anyone can do this on a property. If you're buying a rougher property, people have a tendency to pay their rent because it was a collections problem. It wasn't even a vacancy problem. You had just a bajillion people not paying. We came in and said, okay, we are going to show them that we are going to be better landlords than the last people. Before we ask them for more money, we're going to go ahead and do our job. I asked the contractors to, when we got our request, a lot of people didn't even bother to submit their request. So I'm like, okay, we have four ovens and we have like six fridges that need to come in. And someone didn't have a toilet seat apparently for 2 years. And I was like, that is insane. So at the same time, we coordinated the contractors, fridges, ovens, a toilet seat, a few toilets that are being replaced, fans, they all arrive at the same time. And I'm like, if you guys can just come in and just like, at the highest traffic time of the day possible, just unload everything at the same time and start going. I want everyone to see that we are immediately investing in the property. What happened was exactly what we wanted. We got a wave of additional maintenance requests. All of the other tenants started realizing, wait a second, these new owners are actually going to do something. We fixed the things and then we went door to door. Like literally just Cody and I, we had one employee at the time. We went out there door to door and said, hey, we'd like to get you guys in new leases. I know you guys haven't paid in a while. I also don't blame you for not paying in a while. There's a lot of stuff that needs to be fixed. We are here to fix the problems. And what happened is we got like just doing that. We went from $5,000 a month to about $17,000 a month. We leased up a few units. Out of the cash flow of that, we started fixing up more units and we fixed them up very nice. So now we're starting to lease nice inventory. You get nicer people in there. But we actually didn't kick out any of the existing tenants. We came through and worked with everyone. When we were done with our project, we had two total evictions in that building. We got everyone but two people paying.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, super fun.
But now let's morph into how you now doing the property management remotely with all your, you know, you mentioned you had 200 rental properties across, you know, Washington and Texas. How is that being achieved now with the companies that you've started?
I know, 300 next week, and we do third party. So we have, I'm buying another 44 this. It wasn't going to close next week. It'll close right after Christmas. So end of the month, I'll finally cross 300 units. We're taking another 85 under management on January 6th. So yeah, we expand really fast. To run those operations, you need one person in the driver's seat. And if you're I've been doing this for a while, and I actually have made a lot of money doing real estate over the last few years. We've had a lot of deals, and I have either 100% or very high equity stakes in all of my deals. I don't syndicate. It's either joint ventures or I just buy them myself. So we have this portfolio that's mine, and I might have a partner here and there. And then we'll have property management. I don't want to be day-to-day in every single piece of property management anymore. I'm doing a lot of buying. I'm doing a lot of teaching. I'm running my companies. So you need to have someone who's very qualified, who understands each aspect of the company. You need them to actually be in the driver's seat of the company. That is the only time I give away equity in a business, is I'm like, hey, I need a strategic partner who is willing to do a lot of work and who wants to actually sit in this company. So I own majority of the company. And then I have a head of PM who has an equity stake and a salary in the company. That is a really good way to start, I've found. It's a really good incentive when you have less cash in the beginning of your business. They help me hire out the leasing agents and then get together the roster of contractors. For contractors, I like to have three for each role. So I have a list of three locksmiths, three plumbers, three electricians. We go through the list and we're like, okay, we have everything that we would like to have here. Bookkeeping, I have a few good third-party auditors that I really like. So that's the one piece I'm happy to sit in. I have an accounting degree. I can sit down in the accounting pocket. But I have the actual bank recs done by a third-party team. But you put together all of the pieces and you just have to go, hey, at the end of the day, are we doing well on maintenance? Are we doing well on communication with tenants and owners? Are we doing well on bookkeeping? If you can nail those three things, that is all that really matters in property management. If you're lacking in one, you figure out how to plug the hole. The only rule is you can't lose profitability. So sometimes I want to expand something. You look at the account, there's not enough money. Now it's time for Christian to put on a sales hat. We need to bring on more business. But we've set it up to where I pay myself very little out of my PM companies, if I bother to at all. What I've done in my PM companies, though, is I've taken on just enough third-party management to subsidize the cost of the employees that run my portfolio. So property management is effectively free to me because the properties that we manage very, very well for our neighbors pay for the staff that manages all of my property. And so I've made it so that it's a non-expense for me, which is worth more than actually paying myself a salary. That's the model that I went for as an owner who's also in property management.
Love it. I love it. Do you have set up within the different regions that you have your property? So the person you mentioned offering a little bit of equity for the head of PM. So do you have someone in Seattle that just does all Seattle properties? Or do you have someone in Texas who just does all the Texas stuff? So you sort of splitting it up and they're being more localized to the area. So they have that like touch and feel.
Yes. My solution for managing in Seattle and Texas was I don't want to do both.
Mm-hmm.
So I seller financed my PM company in Washington State. That was the solution there. And I passed that off to someone who I already, just like most seller financing, this has been my strategy. Meet with the people who've done what you want to do. It was someone who I already knew, liked, and trusted.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got terms no one else would have got because I would rather have been cashed out. However, I was able to sell the company to the person who I trusted to operate my portfolio and grow that company. The trade-off was, okay, I'm going to do a structure where I get paid off over 3 years and they pay off a third of the note each year. So I let them stagger out those payments, do it out of cash flow. I ended up being a really, really, really smart idea for how I wanted to do it. In Texas, you set up, I like to put one person, that one head person, they're my overwatch. I also like them to live close enough to me where we can meet in person every once in a while. I personally, we can Zoom all you want, but I like meeting in person with my head people.
Mm-hmm.
I have I own on the border of Texas. I own in Houston, Texas. I own a lot in Stephenville, Texas, which is about an hour south of Fort Worth. You have to set up silos in each of those markets. A strategy that has worked very well for me that I recommend to everyone. If you buy one property in one market and you want to actually optimize your cost, buy a lot of stuff in that market. I bought 25 units in Stephenville. Then I bought a 26 unit. Now we're closing on a 44. I just went under contract for a 76 unit. That's one place I can use the same team everywhere. In my Laredo portfolio, I have to set up a whole different roster of contractors, a whole different roster of leasing. Don't expand before you've really put a good footprint down and got all of your systems in one place. I've had friends who bought a lot of deals, and they were empirically, like if you look at them mathematically, they're good deals. And they got obliterated by being in markets all over the place trying to manage all the teams. The projects didn't happen. Occupancy started going down because they couldn't turn units fast enough. Scale aggressively, but measure your scaling. If you're not there on property management in one market, don't jump to another market. Mm-hmm. But that's how we set it up. You have one person who's basically overwatch, and then you put different silos in. You have managers who report to the, you know, a head property manager, and then you have, you know, leasing agents who report to them. You have maintenance crew. I still outsource maintenance. At some point, we'll probably end up bringing that in house, but we'll wait till we're a little farther before I do another project.
Gotcha. Well, look, as we come to wrap up the show, what's the biggest piece of advice you can give to listeners out there in, you know, looking to get into your space?
If I can give a double, there's two things that really changed for me. Number one was when we got started, I really was stuck on, I don't have the money, so I can't find a deal. I would say if you're going to pursue financial freedom at any level, the first thing that you need to do is you need to know where you're actually headed. And that is, I know what I want my life to look like, and I know exactly what that costs, and I know how long I want to take to get there. That is what an actual goal looks like. When I wanted to be richer, it took me 8 years to buy 4 units. When I wanted to retire my wife, build a house, start a family within 2 years, I hit it. Only because I knew exactly where I was going and I engineered a plan to do that. So number one is do that. Second, don't add steps. Once you know where you're going, A to B, we have such a huge habit to qualify ourselves like you would for a job. You're buying rentals, you're an entrepreneur. Just do the thing that you want to do. Like, what would I need to do to actually buy multifamily? It's not get a broker's license. It's not go work for the CoStar Group. It's learn to underwrite a deal, identify an opportunity, line up the appropriate debt products available to you. And then if you need more equity, you already have a deal mostly funded because you found the debt product. Go find the last little bit of money. Everyone, like I did on that first deal, everyone, if you're going to make $2 million and you believe you'll make $2 million, everyone can find $300,000. To make $2 million, you will absolutely freaking do that. And that's what we did. And it wasn't hard. It took 4 phone calls. I'd never raised money before. Everyone I raised from, I'd never met before.
Love it.
Took 4 phone calls. 3 people came together, funded the deal. Bought them out in 11 months. That is how the game is played. Don't add steps.
Well, mate, at the end of every show, we'd love to dive into the top 5 investing tips. You ready to get into it? Question number one is, what's the daily habit you practice to keep on track towards your goals?
I spend time to actually think. No, don't get me wrong. I work a ton of hours. I have way too many jobs. I am crazy, crazy busy, but I still set aside time to actually meditate and think on the business. I meet a lot of entrepreneurs who don't do this, and they're just scattered all over the place, and they don't really build anything huge. Your time to actually think is a practice that you need to have if you want to lead a successful company.
Love it. Question number two is, who's the most influential person in your career to date?
Most influential person in my career was a terrible real estate investor who had zero business ethics. He was a wizard at buying everything. I worked for him for a little over one year. Watching him lose his business, he was a genius in creative finance. I learned how to buy anything, and I learned almost everything about what not to do in business. There are many times where I sit down and ask myself, would this guy do this? And then my wife and I go, good, that is the wrong thing to do. Let's not do it. Learning what not to do was 100 times more valuable to me than learning what to do.
What's the most influential tool in your business? And when I say tool, it could be a physical tool like a journal or a phone, or it could be a piece of software you just can't run the business without. What is it?
Google Maps.
Okay.
I don't spend any money on leads because my whole strategy is based on meeting the people who've done what I want to do. And that's also how you get most creative finance terms I found, is the the sellers know and like you, and all of a sudden your down payments go down because they want to sell the building to you. That's happened to me many, many, many times. So for me, I don't need a large lead list. I don't have VAs, cold callers, dialers. Google Maps, I can look up a large roof in a residential area, probably a multifamily building. You can drive that street on Google Maps. You can Google their phone number. It doesn't take a long time. If you make two calls a day, you'll meet with one or two owners every weekend for coffee. I meet with 52 to 100 people who own real estate in my markets every year. That is my pipeline. So for me, the free tool of Google Maps, that launched me. And today, that's still how I meet like 100 brand new owners in markets all around the country every single year.
I love it. Absolutely love it. Question number four is, what's been the biggest failure in your career? What did you learn from that failure?
Biggest failure was I bought hospitality. I thought incorrectly that my business was I am a real estate investor who is really skilled in seller finance. What I am is I am a value add and entry level multifamily investor who happens to be very good at creative finance. Buying a different asset class, I put people who had no experience in it. Like I put my best people on a project they had no business being in at all, distracted from the rest of my business. It has 9 employees and it's a 20 cabin resort, historic resort, hot tubs for each cabin on the water, foothill of the mountain, beautiful. We got a 4.5% debt product on it, but it takes so much time and it's still too small to have a full-time manager and still hit the budget, which means I have an active job until I sell that. And there's not a huge buyer pool for a beautiful 20 cabin resort in the middle of nowhere. So that cost me well over $1 million of opportunity cost. I mean, unbelievably over $1 million of like other things I could be doing with my time. And all the value was built into the terms. So if I sell it, I lose a ton of money. If I keep it, I make millions of dollars. But all the value, I slightly overpaid for it, but I got amazing long-term, low interest rate, fixed rate debt. All the value is in the debt. So if you sell it and the debt's not transferable, I lose the value of the deal. So that entire deal from deal structure to asset type, I learned to stay in my lane. Know what you are best at and where you can compete to try to be the best in the world and stay in that lane. Just do the thing that you know to do. Money should be boring.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Last question is, where can people reach you to continue the conversation? They want to be in your sphere. Where do they go?
All right. Instagram, Christian Osgood. I have a unique enough name where I can just use my name as my tag. Love it. If you guys want to learn more about the strategies that we use, because we do a ton of creative finance. I have a little over 2,000 videos on YouTube, multifamily strategy. We finally got over the 100,000 subs. So I finally got that darn plaque. That's been a goal for a long time. A lot of videos. By the way, 2,000 videos to get there is terrible. That takes a lot. That took a lot of content before I finally got one to take off. But the channel is awesome. I documented before I owned rentals. You can actually see me like in the basement being like, this is my business plan all the way through to where we're at today with 300 rentals and the property management companies. Check that out. That's Multifamily Strategy on YouTube. Anything else I have, there's going to be links in the video descriptions.
I want to just summarize what I think I've took a takeaway from today's shows. I think it's your ability to identify ways to do things more efficiently. And when you have, that is such a power in... You mentioned earlier about the steps and qualifying. I think there's something that is coming from that for me, but listening to your story is like, you know, the property management is like, well, I don't have to keep qualifying myself to do the property management. I'm just going to go out and do it, right? And then I'm going to go and create a decentralized, you know, property management company, but I also need to understand my limitations around, you know, making sure I've got enough scale in a market before going somewhere else. Understanding how to break up the pieces and then look at it at a very, very keep it simple, stupid type of mindset, which is, I think, is what the lens you're looking at a lot of things through, becomes complicated. Things become less complicated. And if you keep it like that, you know, the Google Maps is just a beautiful, you know, an example of that. You can then simplify a lot of things in life. And I think that we do get sort of a little bit too in the noise and overcomplicate things and overthink things. And that's what causes us to not ever take or move forward or take action or do whatever that might be. So really, really appreciate you coming on the show. Did I summarize the show up in terms of what I took away from it? Because I think that's what I took away and hopefully the listeners did as well.
I think so. It's that concept of don't add steps. Like, you can't skip steps. Get right. in a community or around people who can show you what steps you need to take to go from A to B. And those people are the people who have already done what you want to do. But then don't add a bunch of existing or additional qualifications to get there. It's the craziest thing that people do. And we all do it. I think we're trained to think that way.
Yep.
But it's like, you don't need to qualify yourself to be an entrepreneur. You need to identify what you have to do and go out and do it.
Love it. Love it, mate. Look, thank you so much for taking your time out of your week. Go enjoy your young son. We'll catch up very, very soon. Enjoy Texas. Congratulations. And we'll talk next time.
All right. Thanks so much.
Well, there you have it. Another cracking episode jam-packed with some incredible advice from Christian. If you do want to check him out, he's got a very, very unique name. It's Christian Osgood, OSGOOD on Instagram. He's got all the multifamily strategy on YouTube. So please go check him out. If you want to give this show a 5-star review, it's the easiest way to give back. And we're going to do this all again next week. So remember, be bold, be brave, and go give life a crack.